Penguin Random House Audio presents Prince Lestat, The Vampire Chronicles, by Anne Rice. Read for you by Simon Vance. This book is dedicated to Stan Rice, Michelle Rice, Christopher Rice, and Karen O'Brien and Cynthia Rice Rogers, Victoria Wilson, Lynn Nesbitt, Eric Shaw Quinn, Suzanne Marie Scott Kiros, and the people of the page. And to my muses, Mary Fall and John Bon Jovi. From my stone pillow, I have dreamed dreams of the mortal world above. I have heard its voice, its new music, as lullabies as I lie in my grave. I have envisioned its fantastic discoveries. I have known its courage in the timeless sanctum of my thoughts. And though it shuts me out with its dazzling forms, I long for one with the strength to roam it fearlessly, to ride the devil's road through its heart. Alessandra, yet unnamed in The Vampire Lestat. Old truths and ancient magic, revolution and invention, all conspire to distract us from the passion that in one way or another defeats us all. And weary finally of this complexity, we dream of that long-ago time when we sat upon our mother's knee, and each kiss was the perfect consummation of desire. What can we do but reach for the embrace that must now contain both heaven and hell, our doom again and again and again? Lestat, in The Vampire Lestat. In the flesh all wisdom begins. Beware the thing that has no flesh. Beware the gods, beware the idea, beware the devil. Maharet, to Jesse, in The Queen of the Damned. Blood Genesis. In the beginning were the spirits. They were invisible beings, heard and seen only by the most powerful sorcerers or witches. Some were thought to be malevolent. Some were praised as good. They could find lost objects, spy upon enemies, and now and then affect the weather. Two great witches, Makare and Maharet, lived in a beautiful valley on the side of Mount Carmel, and they communed with the spirits. One of these spirits, the great and powerful Amel, could, in his mischief-making, take blood from human beings. Tiny bits of blood entered the alchemical mystery of the spirit, though how no one knew. But Amel loved the witch Makare, and was ever eager to serve her. She saw him as no other witch ever had, and he loved her for it. One day the troops of an enemy came, soldiers of the powerful Queen Akasha of Egypt. She wanted the witches, she wanted their knowledge, their secrets. This wicked monarch destroyed the valley and the villages of Makare and Maharet, and brought the sisters by force to her own kingdom. Amel, the furious familiar spirit of the witch Makare, sought to punish the queen. When she lay dying, stabbed over and over by conspirators of her own court, this spirit, Amel, entered into her, fusing with her body and her blood and giving her a new and terrifying vitality. This fusion caused a new entity to be born into the world, the vampire, the blood drinker. From the blood of this great vampire queen, Akasha, all the other vampires of the whole world were born over the millennia. A blood exchange was the means of procreation. To punish the twins who stood opposed to her and her new power, Akasha blinded Maharet and tore the tongue from Makare. But before they could be executed, the steward of the queen, Keman, a newly made blood drinker himself, passed on to the twins the powerful blood. Cayman and the twins led a rebellion against Akasha, but they could not stop her cult of blood-drinker gods. Eventually the twins were captured and separated, sent out as castaways, Maharet into the Red Sea, and Makare into the great ocean to the west. Maharet soon found familiar shores and thrived, but Makari, carried across the ocean to lands yet undiscovered and unnamed, vanished from history. This was 6,000 years ago. The great Queen Akasha and her husband, King Enkil, went mute after 2,000 years, maintained like statues in a shrine by elders and priests that believed Akasha contained the sacred core, and that if she should be destroyed, all the blood drinkers of the world would die with her. But by the time of the Common Era, the story of the blood genesis was completely forgotten. Only a few elder immortals passed on the tale, though they did not believe it even as they told it. Yet blood gods, vampires dedicated to the old religion, still reigned in shrines throughout the world. Imprisoned in hollowed-out trees or brick cells, these blood gods starved for blood until the holy feasts at which they were brought offerings, evildoers to judge and condemn and feast upon. At the dawn of the Common Era, an elder, a keeper of the divine parents, abandoned Akasha and Enkil in the desert for the sun to destroy them. All over the world, young blood drinkers perished, burnt to death in their coffins, their shrines, or in their tracks as the sun shone on the mother and father. But the mother and father themselves were too strong to perish, and many of the very old ones survived as well, though badly burned and in pain. A newly made blood drinker, a wise Roman scholar by the name of Marius, went down to Egypt to find the king and queen and protect them, so that no holocaust would ever again ravage the world of the undead. And thereafter, Marius made them his sacred responsibility. The legend of Marius and those who must be kept endured for almost 2 millennia. In the year 1985, the story of this blood genesis was told to all the world's undead. That the queen lived, that she contained the sacred core, this was part of the story. It appeared in a book written by the vampire Lestat, who also told the tale in song and dance, in film and from the stage, where he performed as a rock singer, calling the world to know and destroy his own kind. Lestat's voice waked the queen from millennia of silence and slumber. She rose with a dream that she would dominate the world of human beings through cruelty and slaughter and become for them the Queen of Heaven. But the ancient twins came forward to stop Akasha. They, too, had heard Lestat's songs. Maharet appealed to the Queen to stop her superstitious blood tyranny, and the long-lost Makari, rising from the earth after untold eons, decapitated the great Queen, and took the sacred core into herself as she devoured the dying queen's brain. Makari, under the protection of her sister, became the new queen of the damned. Lestat once again wrote the story. He had been there. He had seen the passing of the power with his own eyes. He gave his testimony to everyone. The mortal world took no notice of his fictions. But his tales shocked the undead. And so the story of origins and ancient battles, of vampire powers and vampire weaknesses, and wars for control of the dark blood, became the common knowledge of the undead tribe the world over. It became the property of old ones who'd been comatose for centuries in caves or graves, of young ones misbegotten in jungles or swamps or urban slums, who had never dreamed of their antecedents. It became the property of wise and secretive survivors who had lived in isolation through the ages. It became the legacy of all blood drinkers the world over to know they shared a common bond, a common history, a common root. This is the tale of how that knowledge changed the tribe and its destiny forever. Blood Argo. When the vampire Lestat wrote his books, he used any number of terms taught to him by the vampires he had encountered in his life, and those vampires who added to his work, offering their memoirs and their experiences in written form, added terms of their own, some much more ancient than those ever revealed to Lestat. This is a list of those terms which are now common amongst the undead throughout the world. The blood. When the word is capitalized, it refers to vampiric blood, passed on from master to fledgling through a deep and often dangerous exchange. In the blood means that one is a vampire. The vampire Lestat had over 200 years in the blood when he wrote his books. The great vampire Marius has over 2,000 years in the blood, and so forth and so on. Blood drinker, the most ancient term for vampire. This was Akasha's simple term, which she later sought to supplant with the term blood god for those who followed her spiritual path and her religion. Blood wife or blood spouse, one's vampire mate. Children of the millennia, term for immortals who have lived more than 1,000 years, and most specifically for those who have survived more than 2. Children of the night, common term for all vampires or all those in the blood. Children of Satan, term for vampires of late antiquity and after, who believed they were literally children of the devil and serving God through serving Satan as they fed upon humankind. Their approach to life was penitential and puritanical. They denied themselves all pleasure except drinking blood and occasional sabbats, large gatherings, at which they danced, and they lived underground, often in filthy and dismal catacombs and enclosures. The children of Satan have not been seen nor heard of since the 18th century, and in all likelihood the cult has died out. The Coven of the Articulate, a modern slang term popular among the undead for the vampires whose stories appear in the Vampire Chronicles, particularly Louis, Lestat, Pandora, Marius, and Armand. The Dark Gift, a term for the vampiric power. When a master bestows the blood on a fledgling, that master is offering the dark gift. The dark trick refers to the act of actually making the new vampire, to draw out the fledgling's blood and to replace it with one's own powerful blood, is to work the dark trick. The Devil's Road, medieval term among the vampires for the road each vampire takes through this world, a popular term of the children of Satan who saw themselves as serving God through serving the devil. To ride the devil's road was to live one's life as an immortal. The First Brood. These are the vampires descended from Cayman who were in rebellion against Queen Akasha. The Queen's Blood. These are the vampires made by Queen Akasha to follow her path in the blood and fight the rebels of the First Brood. The Sacred Core. This refers to the residing brain or governing life force of the spirit Amel, which is inside the body of the vampire Makari. Before it was in Makari, it was in the vampire Akasha. It is believed that every vampire on the planet is connected to the Sacred Core by some sort of invisible web or network of tentacles. If the vampire containing the Sacred Core were to be destroyed, all the vampires of the planet would die. The Fire Gift. This is the ability of older vampires to use their telekinetic power to burn matter. They can, through the power of their minds, burn wood, paper, or any flammable substance. And they can burn other vampires as well, igniting the blood in their bodies and reducing them to cinders. Only older vampires possess this power, but no one can say when and how a vampire acquires it. A very young vampire made by an ancient one may immediately possess the power. A vampire must be able to see that which he or she wants to burn. In sum, no vampire can burn another if he cannot see that vampire, if he is not close enough to direct the power. The Cloud Gift. This is the ability of older vampires to defy gravity, to rise up and move in the upper atmosphere and to cover long distances easily, travelling the winds unseen by those below. Again, no one can say when a vampire might acquire this power. The will to have it may work wonders. All truly ancient ones possess it, whether they know it or not. Some vampires despise the power, and never use it unless forced. The mind gift. This is a loose and imprecise term which refers to the preternatural powers of the vampiric mind on many levels. Through the mind gift, a vampire might learn things from the world above, even when he is sleeping in the earth below. And consciously using the mind gift, he might telepathically listen to the thoughts of mortals and immortals. He might use the mind gift to pick up images from others as well as words. He might use the mind gift to project images into the minds of others. And finally, he might use the mind gift to telekinetically open a lock, push open a door, or stop the progress of an engine. Again, vampires develop the mind gift slowly over time, and only the most ancient can rape the minds of others for information they do not wish to give, or send a telekinetic blast to rupture the brain and blood cells of a human being or another vampire. A vampire can listen to many the world over, hearing and seeing what others hear, but to destroy telekinetically, he or she must be able to see the intended victim. The spell gift. This refers to the power of vampires to confuse, beguile, and spellbind mortals, and sometimes other vampires. All vampires, even fledglings, have this power to some extent, though many don't know how to use it. It involves a conscious attempt to persuade the victim of the reality the vampire wants the victim to embrace. It doesn't enslave the victim, but it does confuse and mislead. It depends on eye contact. One can't spellbind anyone from a distance. In fact, it more often involves words as well as glances, and certainly involves the mind gift on some level. Fledgling. A new vampire, very young in the blood. Also one's own offspring in the blood. For example, Louis is the fledgling of Lestat. Armand is the fledgling of Marius. The ancient twin Maharet is the fledgling of her twin Mekari. Mekari is the fledgling of the ancient Cayman. Cayman is the fledgling of Akasha. The little drink. Stealing blood from a mortal victim without the victim knowing it or feeling it, without the victim having to die. Maker. Simple term for the vampire who brought one into the blood, being slowly replaced by the term mentor. Sometimes the maker is also referred to as the master. However, this has gone out of use. In many parts of the world, it is considered a great sin to rise up against or seek to destroy one's maker. A maker can never hear the thoughts of a fledgling, and vice versa. The Queen of the Damned. Term given to the vampire Mekari by her sister Maharet, once Mekari had taken the sacred core into herself. It was ironic. Akasha, the fallen queen who had sought to dominate the world, had called herself the Queen of Heaven. The Savage Garden, a term used by Lestat for the world, fitting with his belief that the only true laws of the universe are aesthetic laws, the laws that govern the natural beauty we see all around us on the planet. The Undead, common term for vampires of all ages. Part 1. The Vampire Lestat. 1. The Voice. Years ago, I heard him. He'd been babbling. It was after Queen Akasha had been destroyed and the mute red-haired twin Mekari had become the Queen of the Damned. I'd witnessed all that. The brutal death of Akasha in the moment when we all thought we would die too along with her. It was after I'd switched bodies with a mortal man and come back into my own powerful vampiric body, having rejected the old dream of being human again. It was after I'd been to heaven and hell with a spirit called Memnoch and come back to earth a wounded explorer with no appetite any more for knowledge, truth, beauty. Defeated, I'd lain for years on the floor of a chapel in New Orleans, in an old convent building, oblivious to the ever-shifting crowd of immortals around me, hearing them, wanting to respond, yet somehow never managing to meet a glance, answer a question, acknowledge a kiss or a whisper of affection. And that's when I first heard the voice, masculine, insistent, inside my brain. Babbling, like I said. And I thought, well, perhaps we blood drinkers can go mad like mortals, you know, and this is some artifact of my warped mind. Or maybe he is some massively crippled ancient one slumbering somewhere nearby, and somehow I, telepathically, get to share in his misery. There are physical limits to telepathy in our world, of course. But then voices, pleas, messages, thoughts can be relayed through other minds, and conceivably this poor slob could be mumbling to himself on the other side of the planet. As I said, he had babbled, mixing languages, ancient and modern, sometimes stringing a whole sentence out in Latin or Greek, and then lapsing into repetitions of modern voices, phrases from films and even songs. Over and over he begged for help, rather like the tiny human-headed fly at the end of the B-movie masterpiece. Help me! Help me! As if he too were caught in a spider-web and a giant spider were closing in on him. Okay, okay, what can I do? I'd ask. And he was quick to respond. Near at hand, or just the best relay system in the undead world? Hear me! Come to me! And he'd say that over and over again, night after night, until it was noise. I have always been able to tune him out. No problem. Either you learn to tune out telepathic voices when you are a vampire, or you go straight out of your mind. I can tune out the cries of the living just as easily. Have to. No other way to survive. Even the very ancient ones can tune out the voices. I've been in the blood for over 200 years. They've been in the blood for 6 millennia. Sometimes he simply went away. Around the early years of the 21st century, he began to speak in English. Why? I asked. Because you like it, he said in that crisp, masculine tone of his. Laughter. His laughter. Everybody likes English. You must come to me when I call you, he said. Then he was babbling again, in a melange of languages, all about blindness, suffocation, paralysis, helplessness. And it devolved into help me again, with snatches of poetry in Latin and Greek and French and English. This is interesting for maybe 3/4 of an hour. After that, it's repetitious and a nuisance. Of course, I did not even bother to say no. At one point he cried out, Beauty! And babbled on incessantly, always getting back to Beauty! And always with an exclamation point I could feel like the jab of a finger against my temple. Okay, Beauty, so what? I asked. He moaned, wept, went into dizzying incoherent reverie. I tuned him out for a year, I think. But I could feel him rumbling under the surface, and then 2 years after that, it might have been, he started addressing me by name. Lestat, you Brat Prince! Oh, get off it! No, you Brat Prince, my Prince, boy, oh boy, Lestat! Then he ran those words through 10 modern languages and 6 or 7 ancient ones. I was impressed. So tell me who you are. Or else, I said glumly. I had to confess when I was extremely lonely, I was happy to have him around. And that was not a good year for me. I was wandering aimlessly. I was sick of things. I was furious with myself that the beauty of life wasn't sustaining me, wasn't making my loneliness bearable. I was wandering at night in jungles and in forests with my hands up, to touch the leaves of the low branches, crying to myself, doing a lot of babbling of my own. I wandered through Central America, visiting Maya ruins, and went deep down into Egypt to walk in the desert wastes, and see the ancient drawings on the rocks on the way to the ports of the Red Sea. Young maverick vampires kept invading the cities where I roamed, Cairo, Jerusalem, Mumbai, Honolulu, San Francisco, and I grew weary of disciplining them, punishing them for slaughtering the innocent in their misbegotten hunger. They'd get caught, thrown into human jails where they'd burn up when dawn came. Occasionally, they'd fall into the hands of actual forensic scientists. Bloody nuisance. Nothing ever came of it, but more on that later. The mavericks, multiplying everywhere, were causing trouble for one another, and their gang fights and brawls have made life ugly for the rest of us. And they think nothing of trying to burn with fire or decapitate any other blood drinker who gets in their way. It is chaos. But who am I to police these preternatural nincompoops? When have I ever been on the side of law and order? I'm supposed to be the rebellious one, l'enfant terrible. So I let them drive me away out of the cities, and even from New Orleans I let them drive me away. My beloved Louis de Pointe-du-Lac left soon after, and from that time on lived in New York with Armand. Armand keeps the island of Manhattan safe for them, Louis, Armand, and two young blood drinkers, Benjamin and Cybele, and whoever else joins them in their palatial digs on the Upper East Side. No surprises there. Armand has always been skilled at destroying those who offended him. He was, after all, for hundreds of years the coven master of the old Children of Satan in Paris, and he'd burn to ashes any blood drinker who didn't obey the vicious old rules of those miserable religious fanatics. He's autocratic, ruthless. Well, he can have that mission. But let me add here that Armand isn't the moral cipher I once thought he was. So much of what I thought about us, our minds, our souls, our moral evolution or devolution, was just wrong in the books I wrote. Armand's not without compassion, not without a heart. In many respects, he's just coming into himself after 500 years. And what do I really know about being immortal? I've been in the blood since when? 1780? That's not very long. Not very long at all. I've been to New York, by the way, to spy on my old friends. I've stood outside their gorgeous Upper East Side dwelling on warm nights, listening to the young vampire Cybele play the piano, and Benjamin and Armand talking by the hour. Such impressive dwellings. 3 townhouses attached to one another, and made into one grand palazzo, each with its own Grecian portico and front steps and little decorative iron fencing. Only the central entrance was used with a bronze name inscript above the door. Trinity Gate. Benji's the vampire, responsible for the radio talk show beaming out of New York night after night. In the first years it was broadcast in the regular way. But now it's internet radio and reaches the undead all over the world. Benji's clever in ways no one could have predicted. A Bedouin by birth, brought into the blood at age 12, perhaps, so he'll be 5 feet 2 inches tall and small forever. But he's one of those immortal children whom mortals always take for a diminutive adult. I can't hear Louis when I'm spying, of course, since I made him, and makers and fledglings are deaf to each other. But my preternatural ears have never been better. Outside their house, I easily picked up his rich, soft voice and the images of Louis in the minds of the others. I could see the vividly colored Baroque murals on their ceilings through the billowing lace curtains. Lots of blue there. Blue skies with rich, rolling, gold-tinged clouds. Why not? And I could smell those crackling fires. The townhouse complex was 5 stories, belle époque and grand. Basements underneath and, high up there, an immense attic ballroom with a glass ceiling open to the stars. They'd made it into a palace, all right. Armand has always been good at that, drawing on unimaginable reserves to pave his stunning headquarters in marble and antique plank, and to furnish the rooms with the finest designs ever produced, and he always made them secure. The sad little icon painter from Russia, kidnapped and plunged into the West, had long ago embraced its humanist vision utterly. Marius, his maker, surely must have seen this with some satisfaction a long time ago. I wanted to join them, always do want to join them, and never do. In fact, I marveled at the way they lived, slipping out in Rolls-Royce limousines to attend the opera, the symphony, the ballet, wandering the museum openings together, so well integrated into the human world around them, even inviting mortals to those gilded salons for wine and refreshments, having mortal musicians in to play. How splendidly they passed for human! I marveled that I had ever lived that way, ever been able to do it with such finesse a century or more ago. I watched them with the eyes of a hungry ghost. The voice rumbled and bellowed and whispered whenever I was there, rolling their names around in a stew of invective and rumination and demand. One evening the voice said, "Beauty is what drove it, don't you see? It was the mystery of beauty." A year later I was walking along the sands of South Beach in Miami, when he broke that one on me again. For the moment the mavericks and rogues had been leaving me alone. They were afraid of me, afraid of all the old ones. But not enough. "Drove what, dear voice?" I asked. I felt it was only fair to give him a few minutes before shutting him down. "You cannot conceive of the magnitude of this mystery," he spoke, in a confidential whisper. "You cannot conceive of this complexity." He was saying these words as if he'd just discovered them. He wept. I swear it, he wept. It was an awful sound. I don't glory in any being's pain, not even the pain of my most sadistic enemies, and here was the voice weeping. I was hunting, thirsting, though I didn't need to drink, at the mercy of the craving, the deep, agonizing lust for heated, pumping human blood. I found a young victim, female, irresistible in her combination of filthy soul and gorgeous body, white throat so tender. I had her in the fragrant, darkened bedroom of her own lodgings, lights of the city beyond the windows, having come over the roofs to find her, this pale woman with glorious brown eyes and walnut-shaded skin, black hair like the snakes of Medusa, naked between the white linen sheets, struggling against me as I sank my fangs right into the carotid artery. Too hungry for anything else. Give me the heartbeat. Give me the salt. Give me the viaticum. Fill my mouth. And then the blood erupted, roared. Don't rush this. I was the victim, suddenly laid waste, as if by a phallic god, slammed by the rushing blood against the floor of the universe, the heart pounding, emptying the frail form it sought to protect. And lo, she was dead. Oh, too soon. Crushed lily on the pillow, except she'd been no lily, and I'd seen her grimy, petty, purple crimes, as that blood made a fool of me, wasted me, left me warm, indeed hot all over, licking my lips. Can't bear to linger near a dead human. Out over the roofs again. "Did you enjoy that voice?" I asked. I stretched like a cat under the moon. He replied. "Have always loved it, of course. Then stop all the weeping." He drifted off then. That was a first. He left me. I hit him with one question after another. No answer. No one there. 3 years ago this happened. I was in a wretched state, down and out, disgusted and discouraged. Things were bad all over the vampire world, no doubt about it. Benji, in his endless broadcasts, was calling for me to come out of exile, and others were joining him in that appeal. "Lestat, we need you!" tales of woe abounded. I couldn't find many of my friends any more, not Marius, or David Talbot, or even the ancient twins. Time was when I could find any and all of them fairly easily, but no more. "We are a parentless tribe," Benji cried over the Internet Vampire radio station. "Young ones, be wise. Flee the old ones when you see them. They are not our elders, no matter how many years they have in the blood. They have refused all responsibility for their brothers and sisters. Be wise." On this dreary, cold night, I've been thirsty, more thirsty than I could bear. Oh, I don't technically need the blood anymore. I have so much blood from Akasha in my veins, the primal blood from the old mother, that I can exist forever without feeding. But I was thirsting, and I had to have it to staunch the misery, or so I told myself on a little late-night rampage in the city of Amsterdam, feeding off every reprobate and killer I could find. I'd hidden the bodies. I'd been careful. But it had been grim, that hot, delicious blood pumping into me, and all those visions with it of filthy and degenerate minds, all that intimacy with the emotions I deplore. Oh, same old, same old. I was sick at heart. In moods like this, I'm a menace to the innocent, and I know it only too well. Around 4 in the morning, it had me so bad, I was in a little public park, sitting on an iron bench in the damp, doubled over in a bad, seedy part of the city, the late-night lights looking garish and sooty through the mist, and I was cold all over, and fearing now that I simply wasn't going to endure. I wasn't going to make it in the blood. I wasn't going to be a true immortal like the great Marius, or Macari, or Mahat, or Haman, or even Armand. This wasn't living what I was doing. And at one point the pain was so acute, it was like a blade turning in my heart and in my brain. I doubled over on the bench. I had my hands clasped on the back of my neck, and I wanted nothing so much as to die. Simply to close my eyes on all of life and die. And the voice came, and the voice said, "But I love you." I was startled. I hadn't heard the voice in such a long time, and there it was, that intimate tone, so soft, so utterly tender, like fingers touching me, caressing my head. "Why?" I asked. "Of all of them, I love you the most," said the voice. "I am with you, loving you now." "What are you? Another make-believe angel?" I said. "Another spirit pretending to be a god, something like that?" "No," he said. But the moment he'd started to speak, I had felt this warmth in me, this sudden warmth such as addicts describe when they are infused with the substance they crave, this lovely, reassuring warmth that I'd found so fleetingly in the blood. And I'd begun to hear the rain, hear it not as this dismal drizzle, but as a lovely, soft symphony of sounds on the surfaces that surrounded me. "I love you," said the voice. "Now get up. Leave this place. You must. Get up. Start walking. This rain is not too cold for you. You are too strong for this rain and too strong for this sorrow. Come on. Do as I tell you." And I had. I had gotten up and started walking and made my way back to the elegant old Hotel de l'Europe, where I was lodged, and I'd gone into the large, exquisitely wallpapered bedroom and closed the long velvet draperies properly over the coming sun. Glare of white sky over the Amstel River. Morning sounds. Then I'd stopped. I'd pressed my fingers to my eyelids and buckled. Buckled under the weight of a loneliness so terrible I would have chosen death then if only I'd had such a choice. "Come now, I love you," said the voice. "You're not alone in this. You never were." I could feel the voice inside me, around me, embracing me. Finally I lay down to sleep. He was singing to me now, singing in French, singing some lyrics put to the beautiful Chopin Etude Tristesse. Lestat, go home to France, to the Auvergne, where you were born, he whispered, just as if he were beside me. Your father's old chateau there, you need to go there. All of you human beings need a home. So tender it sounded, so sincere. So strange that he would say this. I did own the old ruined chateau. Years ago I had set architects and stonemasons to rebuild it, though why I did not know. I saw an image of it now, those ancient round towers rising from that cliff above fields and valleys where in the old days so many had starved, where life had been so bitter, where I had been bitter, a boy bound and determined to run away to Paris, to see the world. Go home, he whispered. Why are you not winking out the way I am, voice? I asked. The sun's rising. Because it is not morning where I am, beloved Lestat. Ah, then you are a blood drinker, aren't you? I asked. I felt I'd caught him. I began to laugh, to cackle. Of course you are! He was furious. You miserable, ungrateful, degenerate brat prince, he was muttering. And then he'd left me again. Ah, well, why not? But I hadn't really solved the mystery of the voice, not by a long shot. Was he just a powerful old immortal communicating from another part of the globe by bouncing his telepathic message off vampiric minds in between, like light bouncing from mirror to mirror? No, that wasn't possible. His voice was too intimate and precise for all that. You can send out a telepathic call to another immortal by that method, of course, but you can't communicate directly, as he had been doing all along with me. When I woke, it was, of course, early evening, and Amsterdam was filled with roaring traffic, whizzing bicycles, myriad voices, scent of blood pumped through beating hearts. "Still with me, voice?" I asked. Silence. Yet I had the distinct feeling, yes, the feeling that he was here. I'd felt wretched, afraid for myself, wondering at my own weakness, inability to love. And then this happened. I went to the full-length mirror on the bathroom door to adjust my tie. You know what a dandy I am. Well, even down and out, I was in a finely cut Armani jacket and dress shirt, and, well, I wanted to adjust this bright, flashing, beautifully hand-painted silk tie, and my reflection wasn't there. I was there, but not my reflection. It was another me, smiling at me with triumphant, glittering eyes, both hands up against the glass as if he were in a prison cell behind it. Same clothes, yes, and me, down to the last detail of long, blonde, curling hair and glittering blue-grey eyes, but not a reflection at all. I was petrified. The dim echo of doppelganger rose in my ears, and all the horror such a concept connotes. I don't know if I can describe how chilling this was, this figure of myself inhabited by another, leering at me, deliberately menacing me. I remained sober-faced, and I continued to adjust my tie, though I could see no reflection of what I was doing. And he continued to smile in that icy, mocking way, as the laughter of the voice rose in my brain. "Am I supposed to like you for this voice?" I asked. "I thought you loved me." He was stricken. His face, my face, crumpled like that of a little boy about to sob. He put his hands up as if to shield himself, fingers hovering, eyes quivering. The image vanished, to be replaced by a true reflection of me, standing there, puzzled, faintly horrified, and not a little angry. I straightened my tie for the last time. "I do love you," said the voice, sadly, almost mournfully. "I love you," and he began to chatter, and roar, and discourse, and all those vocabularies were suddenly tumbling together, Russian, German, French, Latin. That night, when Benji began broadcasting from New York, he said that things could not continue like this. He urged the young ones to flee the cities. He begged once more for the elders of the tribe to step up. I went to Anatolia to escape it all. I wanted to see Hagia Sophia again, to walk under those arches. I wanted to wander the ruins of Göbekli Tepe, the oldest Neolithic settlement ever discovered. To hell with the problems of the tribe. Whatever gave Benji the idea that we were a tribe? 2. Benji Mahmoud. I figured that Benji Mahmoud was probably 12 years old when Marius made him a vampire, but no one knew for sure, including Benji. He'd been born in Israel to a Bedouin family, then hired and imported into the United States by the family of a young female piano player named Sibel, who was clearly insane, so that he could be Sibel's companion. Both young people met the vampire Armand in New York in the mid-1990s, but weren't inducted into the blood till a little later, when Marius worked the dark trick on both of them as a gift to Armand. Of course, Armand was furious, felt betrayed, deplored that the human lives of his charges had been cut short, etc. But Marius had done the only thing that could be done with two humans who were living for all practical purposes in our world, and fast losing taste for any other. Human wards like that are hostages to fortune, and Armand should have known that some vampire enemy or other was going to knock off one or the other, or both of these two young people, just to get at Armand. That's the way such things can too easily go. So Marius brought them over. I was not myself in those days. I was battered and broken, thanks to my adventures with Memnoch, a spirit who claimed to have been the devil of the Christian belief system. And I scarcely noticed all this, only knowing that I loved the music that Sibel made, and little more. By the time I took real notice of Benji Mahmoud, he was living in New York with Armand and Louis and Sibel, and he had invented the radio station. As I mentioned earlier, it was broadcast at first, but Benji was far too inventive to put up with immortal world's constraints on him for long, and he soon operated the program as an internet radio stream out of the townhouse on the Upper East Side, often speaking to the children of the darkness nightly, and inviting their phone calls from all over the world. In the broadcast days, Benji had talked in a low voice under Sibel's music, a voice that, without specific enhancement, couldn't be heard by mortal ears, hoping that the vampires of the world would get the message. Trouble was, a lot of the vampires couldn't hear him either. So when Benji went to internet radio, he dropped that trick. He just talked to us, and paid no attention whatsoever to the vampire fiction enthusiasts or little goths who called the show, weeding them out by the timbre of their voices easily enough to devote his on-air time to real children of darkness. Sibel's exquisite piano music was a major part of the show, and sometimes they broadcast as much as 5 or 6 hours a night, and sometimes not at all. But Benji's message was soon heard from one end of the earth to the other. We are a tribe. We want to survive, and the elders aren't helping us. Now, when he first started to talk of this, of the parentless and the undefended haunting every city on earth, and the negligence and selfishness of the elders, I thought surely somebody would take offense, shut him down, or at least set him back in some dramatic way. But Benji was right about things. I was not. Nobody bothered to stop him because, in fact, nobody cared. And Benji went on talking to the mavericks and rogues and orphans who called his line at night about how to be careful, how to persevere, how to feed on the evildoer and cover up the kill, and remember always that the world belongs to humans. Benji gave the undead everywhere an argo as well, peppering his commentaries with terms from the Vampire Chronicles, including some I hadn't used before or ever heard, perhaps, establishing a language for all to share. Interesting, that. Or at least I found it so. A couple of times I went to New York just to spy on Benji, He'd developed a definite personal style by then. He wore expertly tailored three-piece suits, usually in grey or brown-striped worsted wool, gorgeous pastel dress shirts and flashing Brooks Brothers silk ties, and he always wore a black felt Italian-made fedora, the perfect gangster hat, and spick-and-span wing-tip shoes. As the result, even with his small build, small bones, small round cheerful little face and glittering black eyes, he didn't look like a child at all, but like a little man. And that had become his favourite pet name for himself, Little Man. Little Man owned more than 5 galleries in Chelsea and Soho, a Greenwich Village restaurant just off Washington Square, and an old-fashioned haberdashery shop where he bought his hats. He had legal papers galore, including a legal driver's license, plus credit cards, cell phones, a bicycle or two, and often drove his restored MGTD sports car in New York on summer nights, but mostly went about in a chauffeur-driven black Lincoln stretch limousine, and spent a lot of time in cafes and restaurants, pretending to dine with mortals who found him fascinating. He and Sibel hunted well in the back alleys. They both knew the art of the little drink, and could satisfy themselves with any number of little drinks at nightclubs and charity balls, without ever taking a life or disabling some innocent victim. And whereas Sibel was something of a remote and mysterious presence at his side, gorgeous in designer gowns and costly gems, Benji had scores of human friends who thought of him as eccentric and amusing and delightful with his vampire radio show, which they considered performance art of the most clever sort, assuming he supplied all the voices for the show, including the Japanese and Chinese-speaking children of the night who called in and talked for hours in their native tongue, taxing Benji's preternatural powers to the max as he strove to keep up with them. In sum, Benji was a wild success as a vampire. He had a website backing up the radio show and an email address, and sometimes read emails over the air, so to speak. But it always came back to the same thing. We're a tribe, and as a tribe we need to stick together, have loyalty, care about one another, and figure on lasting in this world where immortals could be burnt up or decapitated like anybody else. The elders have sold us out. And always, always there was Benji's warning to the undead. Don't come to New York. Don't try to find me. I'm here for you by phone and by email, but never set foot in this town or you'll have to face Armand, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone. In fact, he was always warning them that no one city could really support the numbers of vampires being born to darkness now, and fledglings had to be clever, had to seek out new territories, and had to learn to live in peace with others. On the phone, the callers spilled their woe. They were anxious and afraid. They deplored the brawls happening all over, and they were scared to death of the ancient ones who would burn you up on sight. In vain they searched for the great Lestat, the great Marius, the great Pandora, on and on and on. Over and over Benji commiserated, advised, and sometimes just shared their grief. "They don't help us, do they?" Benji would declare. "Why did Lestat write his books? Where is the great scholar David Talbot? And what are the great Jesse Reeves, born to darkness in the arms of the ancient Maharet? What a selfish, self-centered, and self-obsessed bunch they are!" And then he'd start with his, "Lestat, where are you?" Like I'm one of the elders? Come on now, seriously. Well, in terms of influence, yes, of course. I wrote my autobiography. I became the famous rock star, like for 5 minutes. I wrote the story of how Akasha was destroyed and how the fount of power was taken out of her and into the vampire Makari. I admit, I did all that. I wrote and published my account of the body thief and of Memnon. Okay, okay. And yes, if my rock music and rock videos hadn't been loosed into the world, the old Queen Akasha might never have risen from her throne and worked the great burning, in which vampires all over the planet were turned to ashes. My fault, okay, I admitted. But I have, what, 233 years in the blood? something like that. As I said before, I'm a brat by anybody's standards, a reckless kid. The real elders, the ones he was always taunting, insulting, and deriding, were the children of the millennia, the great immortals, Marius and Pandora, and the ancient twins, of course, Megare and Maharet, and their companion, Cheman. Benjy made that clear enough. "How can this Megare be the queen of the damned if she does not rule?" Benjy would ask. "Does not her twin Maharet care for us as a great vampire family? And where is Cheman, old as the twins are? And why does he not care for us as we struggle through the world seeking for answers? How is it that Jesse, young Jesse of our world, does not urge these ancient ones to listen to our voices?" All this was amazing to me, and scary to me, as I've explained. But even if no one moved to silence Benjamin, was it going to come to anything? Was it going to make anything happen? And all the while, other things were happening. Bad things. Really bad things. And some good things, too, perhaps. Benjy was not the only vampire doing something entirely new under the stars of heaven. There was Farid, who had come along well before Benjy. And I hadn't thought Farid would last, either. 3. Farid and Seth. I met Farid and Seth 6 years before the end of the last century. This was after I'd met the body thief, but before I'd met Memnock. And though I'd thought the encounter was an accident at the time, I realized later it most certainly was not, as they'd been searching for me. It was in Los Angeles, on a mild and lovely evening, when I agreed to talk to them in a garden café, not far from where they'd approached me on Sunset Boulevard. Two powerful vampires, one ancient and one young, who was fueled by the powerful blood of the other. Seth was the ancient one, and as always with those great survivors, I knew him by his heartbeat long before I ever saw him. They can cloak their minds, these antique monsters, and they can pass for human, yes, no matter how old they are, and they do. But they can't stop an immortal like me from hearing that heartbeat, and along with it a faint sound like respiration. Only it sounds like an engine purring when it comes from them. And that's the signal, of course, to run, unless you want to be burnt to a fine black powder, or a little grease spot on a pavement. But I don't run from anything, and I wasn't very sure I wanted to be alive any longer back then. I'd lately burnt my skin to dark brown in the Gobi Desert in a failed attempt to end it all, and to say I had a devil-may-care attitude would have been an understatement. Also, I'd survived so much. Wouldn't I survive an encounter with another ancient one? I knew the twins firsthand, did I not? I knew the reigning queen. Did I not have their protection? But I had known something else as well back then, even then, and that was that my rock singing, my videos, and my waking of the queen had waked a number of immortals around the globe, and who and what they were, nobody really knew for certain. I just knew they were out there. And so here I was, walking down Sunset in the thick of the crowds, just loving it, kind of, forgetting I was a monster, forgetting I was no longer a rock star, and pretending more or less to be the beautiful John Bon Jovi. I'd just caught a John Bon Jovi concert a few months prior to this, and on my little Walkman I was playing his songs over and over obsessively. And there I was, you know, strutting, flirting now and then, smiling at the pulchritudinous mortals drifting by, now and then lifting my rose-coloured sunglasses to wink at this one or that, and letting my hair blow free in that eternal, chilling West Coast breeze, and just, well, having a good time, and a bitter time, when there comes that heartbeat, that fatal heartbeat. Well, Maharet and Megare had not disappeared from the world entirely by that point, so I thought, what have I done now? And who is going to bother me about it when I spy coming towards me these two remarkable blood drinkers, the shorter one a good 6 feet in height, with magnificent golden skin and blue-black curling hair around his handsome and inquisitive face, and enormous green eyes and well-formed lips in an open smile. Clothes natty, I suppose, an English bespoke suit, if I was any judge, and beautiful narrow tan bespoke shoes, too, and a taller one. The thin giant, very dark of skin, too, but burnt, I could tell that, and ancient, his black hair very short all over his well-shaped skull, and with almond-shaped eyes, and his clothes eccentric for the streets of West Hollywood, though not perhaps for the city of Cairo or Jeddah. A white ankle-length